reading from Jonah 2. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, "In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the current swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, 'I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple.' The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. But you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord." And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah unto dry land. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. Jonah is one of those stories which we're probably all familiar with, and it's a story which is very briefly contained within four chapters of the book of Jonah. We're coming now to the second chapter. We had the first chapter expounded to us last week by Nick. And in coming to the second chapter, I want to look at some of the background to Jonah, and then look at the chapter itself and some of the truths that we can glean from it. Nineveh, which was where Jonah was sent to preach, was the capital of the empire of Assyria. Nineveh first occurs in historical records 6,000 years before Christ as a small community, rather like Rome on the edge of the Tigris, was a small community which eventually develops and becomes a great center of the Roman Empire. So Nineveh began in a very small, obscure sense. By the second millennium BC, 2,000 years before Christ, Nineveh had become a religious center devoted to, among other gods, the worship of Ishtar. We find in the 9th century, so it's getting nearer to Jonah, that large architectural projects had begun to be built in Nineveh, and it begins to become a center of importance. And by 705 BC, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, moves his capital to Nineveh. We've got some of the artifacts on the screen showing you the sort of things which were familiar in Nineveh. And you can see there the pictures which have been uncovered by archaeologists. A map shows you the location of Nineveh, and the map gives you an indication as to the extent of the Assyrian Empire. And Nineveh is there on the map to give you some idea where it is in relationship to Jerusalem and where Jonah is being directed to go to. Some of the pictures that we have of Assyria show how majestic its buildings were, how large and well fortified it was. Inscriptions show us the type of warfare that they conducted, and all this is part of evidence to the greatness of Assyria, which, if you want to see the originals, you can visit the British Museum and see some of them there. Assyria was a great empire. There's no doubt about that. This is set against a very dramatic period of human history, the emergence of this empire, which was to quickly pass away and be taken over by the Babylonians, who in turn were to pass away and taken over by the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. So in the period of about 400 years, you have something like five mighty empires coming into their fullest blossom and then being overcome, and another empire, wave after wave. We can all too easily, in our own very focused existence, sort of see the world and see history just from the moment that we live in. And I'm stressing this because we're going to be trying to appreciate things that are happening today and how they reflect the things that were happening in the days of Jonah. The book of Jonah has become an important book for the Jews because every year at Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the book is read. And the reason why it's read is it demonstrates that when people genuinely repent and turn to God, God actually hears their prayer. And he holds back judgment. Now that's an incredibly important thing to understand. That God who is holy, God who is righteous and just, delights to pull back his judgment upon a people who've been evil to the great, to an extent that we can't really comprehend. He pulls back. He delights in mercy. And so here every year the Jews actually read from this to encourage the Jewish community to repent of their sins and turn again to God. And the point is that if God can forgive Gentiles, how much more will he forgive his own people, the Jews, if they repent? It's interesting discovering that the Jews find the book of Jonah a bit of an embarrassment because God has had mercy upon these Gentiles so liberally, so graciously. And in fact, if you were to read some of the Jewish commentaries on this book, you'll find that they try to maneuver and say, no, the Gentiles can't be that sincere. They can't really mean that. In actual fact, it was a con trick. The people of Nineveh pretended that they'd repented, but they hadn't really repented, and they fooled God. And of course, when you start talking of fooling God and God holding back his judgment because he was fooled by the Ninevites, well, you've certainly devalued the very notion of who God is. The Jewish commentators can't cope with the fact that God really is merciful to Gentiles as well. And trying their best to maneuver themselves into a position where they don't have to acknowledge and accept it, they make statements which are beyond belief. An interesting thing, in fact, I'd say a fascinating thing, is this, that the Assyrians still exist as a nation today. When I say as a nation, perhaps that's not the right description. A nation has its own land. The Kurds are not a nation. They don't have their own land. The Assyrians are not a nation, but they are still a people. And the chart that's on the screen shows you the distribution of the Assyrians today. In Iraq, there are 1,500,000. In Syria, 700,000. In the USA, 400,000. They're spread throughout the world today, but they are the Assyrian people. They are the descendants of this great, mighty empire that emerged there in the time of Jonah. What I find is incredible is that the Assyrians are not an Islamic people. They're the one people based in the Middle East that are virtually entirely Christian. Now that's quite incredible. They are a Christian people. Now, when I say that, they're split up into many groups, and perhaps you wouldn't even recognize the names that they go under. Syriac Catholic, Chaldean, Church of the East, Syriac Orthodox. But their characteristic is that they boast that they are a Christian people. I find that incredible. That Nineveh repented 2,600 years ago. And God's mercy has been to them to preserve them, actually to protect them from Islam. And even to this day, they benefit from that repentance that their forefathers produced as they heard the preaching of Jonah. course, when you deal with Jonah, there's always, well, what about the whale? The chapter that we're looking at is Jonah being in the whale's belly. Well, in actual fact, the scriptures don't mention whale. The more modern translations get away from speaking of the whale. The actual Hebrew word is a great fish, so it might be a whale. In fact, it could possibly be a sea monster. It could just simply be a great fish. But what we do know is that there are records of people actually being swallowed by great fish and surviving. In February of 1891, a fellow called James Bartley, a sailor aboard a whaling ship, the Star of the East, was swallowed by a whale in the vicinity of the Falkland Islands. He was within the whale for more than 48 hours. And after he was found in the whale, which had been harpooned and brought aboard the whaling ship, it took him 2 weeks to recover from his ordeal. Apparently his condition was really quite dreadful because the acids within the fish's stomach had bleached his hair and his skin. He was in a dreadful mess. Can you imagine Jonah going into Nineveh like this? He'd terrify the life out of people. But that's not the only occasion. A Marshall Jenkins was swallowed by a sperm whale in the South Seas, and the Boston Post Boy of October the 14th, 1771, records that the ship based in USA struck a whale, and the whale reacted and it broke the boat that these men were in. It was obviously a small boat, and it swallowed part of the boat with Jenkins in it, and then shortly afterwards it actually vomited Jenkins back out, and he landed on the ship, or near the ship, that he had been probably in one of these longboats fishing from. So the difficulty of a man being swallowed by some form of great fish is historically verifiable. I don't think that that really is the miraculous element of the story. The miraculous element is that this beast, whatever it was, this creature, actually was there to swallow Jonah. That's what the miracle really is. That Jonah was thrown into the sea and that creature is there to preserve his life. That's really the miracle. We can place Jonah a little bit more precisely in Jewish history because he's referred to in the Old Testament outside of the book of Jonah. And in 2 Kings chapter 14, verses 23 to 25, it says, "In the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. So I hope you understand that Israel, as we think of it, it divided in two. You had the north and the southern kingdom, a bit like Ireland today, where you've got the north and the south. Israel was in that condition. They had two separate kings. And in one section of the kingdom, which was the larger one, Jeroboam becomes the king and his government is based in Samaria. He reigned for 41 years. He was the one who restored the boundaries of Israel from Leo Hamath to the Sea of Arba in accordance with the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, spoken through his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet from Gath-Hepheth. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And he didn't turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which had caused Israel to commit sin." Now this I find is fascinating. Jonah actually prophesied that Jeroboam would expand Israel's borders back to their position, which they'd been some decades earlier. Jonah had actually predicted that. In other words, he was a sort of prophet that would have been sort of in favor. He'd said good things. And this wicked king, Jeroboam, had fulfilled the prophecy. And Israel had been successful in her military ventures and pushed out the enemies, and so she'd repossessed the land. Can you see the significance of this? That this guy, Jonah, is in favor with the royal court. He's not an he's not somebody who is there right on the edges of the community and hardly anybody knows about him. The royal court knows about him. The whole nation knows about him. He made this prophecy. It was fulfilled. The nation now is in a tremendously prosperous position. Under Jeroboam, it's become again a vibrant economic reality. And Jonah was the guy who predicted it. Maybe that helps us to understand why Jonah was not too keen to go prophesying to Israel's number one enemy. So Jonah is there in Israel's history. We'll find that there are three kings that we need to be aware of at this period. They come in and they go out, as it were. One is Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. He eventually brought his armies against Israel, where Jeroboam had been king. And he conquered it and he took many of the people off to Assyria captive. Tiglath-Pileser's successor, Sennacherib, came up against Judah and Jerusalem. He nearly conquered it, but in fact, before he was able to conquer it, he heard that there was a rebellion back in his own capital, and he had to leave this attempt at conquest, and he returned, and he never came back. So Judah escaped the Assyrian conquest, only to have that peace and freedom for a relatively short time before Babylon came under Nebuchadnezzar and conquered Jerusalem and took the people off into captivity, not to Assyria, but to Babylon. So here is the background. Now I want to look at the chapter itself. And the notes on the back of your notice sheet will tell you that we are going to look under the headings of the distress of Jonah, the desire of Jonah, the discovery of Jonah, and the deliverance of Jonah. So, the beginning of the chapter, it says in verse 2, "In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me from the depths of the grave. I called for help, and you listened to my cry." Now, I want to ask a very simple question, although it may be a little bit difficult to grasp. I want to ask if this opening statement is Jonah actually in the sea crying to God, or does it precede him being in the sea? I think most people would take it that it actually is in the sea. But the thing is that the way that Jonah goes on, it seems to me that his first cry is made and then he is cast into the sea. Because if you listen, reading verses 1 to 3, "From inside the fish Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, 'In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas. And the current swirled around me. All your waves and breakers swept over me.'" So what I'm suggesting is actually the reference, "From the depths of the grave I called and called for help, and you heard my cry." This actually is, he's saying that when I was in the boat, I was in the bowels of the vessel, and I was terrified. And I realized that this was all because I was running away from you. And then the sailors found me and they questioned me, and I admitted that I was running away from you. And the storm was because of my disobedience to you, and I wanted to die. And I actually asked them to throw me overboard, and they did. And when they threw me overboard, you did something I didn't expect. You preserved my life. So the opening I would suggest to you is actually referring to his cry to God actually in the boat. And God answers his prayer and he has him thrown into the sea. And whilst God answers his prayer, he actually sort of puts up a limitation. I'm going to answer your prayer. I'm going to have you cast into the sea, but I'm not going to allow what you want to happen to you. I'm going to preserve your life. Maybe you've noticed that there are times that you've had some reason for to be angry with God, and you've told him exactly what you wanted, and it wasn't what you knew he wanted, but you were hurt, you were angry. The last thing you wanted was what you knew God would want. And God said, okay, you can have your request, but it's not going to work out like you think it will work out. Because I've still got my plans for you. I still love you. But if this is what you want, I'm not going to deny you of it. But it's going to be sore and difficult. Maybe if we apply that, we could think of lots and lots of situations where we get angry with God. Why do you impose this on me? Why do I have to cope with this? Why aren't I like other people? Why do these circumstances control my life? Why? You're not a God who's reasonable. You're not a God who loves me. Just let me do my own thing. Let me work it out for myself. And when we argue like that and it carries on, God says, okay, I can't teach you any other way, but it's going to hurt you. You can have what you want. But it's going to hurt you. But I won't stop pursuing you. I won't give up on you. I'm going to be right there at your shoulder. And I'll hear your cry when you cry to me for help. Isn't that a merciful God? Doesn't take away our wills. But can you understand this? If God is doing anything in your life, it's because he loves you. It's never because he has a chip on his shoulder about you. It's not because he wants to deny you the happiness that you crave for, whatever it may be. It's not that. And even though it may mean such incredible discipline and denying the natural inclinations of your heart, I want to urge you to say, Lord, I don't see how this will work out, but I trust you. I trust your infinite wisdom. I trust your love. I trust your compassion, your mercy. You're not my enemy, you're my Father. You're more than my Father. You gave your Son for my forgiveness and salvation. You won't withhold anything that's good for me. Do you understand that? Whatever it is that's getting at you, whatever it is that's destroying you, whatever it is that you hate in your life, whatever it is that you want to change, this is a reality that God doesn't give up on you. He loves you. We need to learn that, don't we? Jonah needed to learn it. And God answered him, and he was thrown into the sea, and there in the sea he discovers, oh God, yes, you've answered my prayer, but I really wanted to die. I didn't just want to be cast into the sea. And God has to say, I haven't finished with you, Jonah, yet. I've got things that you're to fulfill. What was it that caused Jonah to run away from God in the first place? What caused this distress? It was something in his heart which said no to God, and he began to run away from God and what God was telling him to do. God was telling him to go to Nineveh and to preach to Nineveh. And Jonah says, no, I'm not. I'm just not going to do that. Well, the reason, quite sadly, is more than understandable. And my suspicion is that if we were in Jonah's place, we probably would have done something similar. You see, we find in 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 29 to 30, just an insight as to the problems that were going on at this period. Listen to this. While Josiah was king, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up to the Euphrates River to help the king of Assyria. King Josiah marched out to meet him in battle, but Necho faced him and killed him at Megiddo. Josiah's servants brought his body in a chariot from Megiddo to Jerusalem and buried him in his own tomb. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in place of his father. You see, here are the Egyptians, and they were marching hundreds and hundreds of miles up towards Assyria, actually to give them support, military support. And Josiah is saying, if he succeeds, they'll be invincible. The thing is, it mustn't happen. And Josiah, who is elevated to be one of the most godly kings that Israel, Judah had ever had, Josiah decides he's got to intervene, and he takes his armies and he goes out and he engages the king of Egypt. And he's killed in battle. And so the Egyptian army carries on. And it gives support to the Assyrians to establish them. That's how terrified the Jewish people were of what was happening in Assyria. And Jonah understood this, that the Assyrians would one day be the very instruments that God would use to chastise the Jewish people. He knew that this emerging mighty empire was soon to look further and to start expanding its ambitions, and soon its armies would be flooding in to the land of Israel. Soon they would be conquered. And Jonah said, I don't want to go. I'm not going to preach to them. I want your judgment on them. And wouldn't you be doing that? Wouldn't I be doing that? Let me remind you, Jonah had preached, and it happened, and Israel had been blessed. But he knows now that if he preaches and Nineveh repents, it's actually the judgment upon Israel. And he doesn't want that. What are you afraid of? I want to move it to a bigger thing than what are you afraid of. I want to ask you, are you aware of the changes that you and your children and grandchildren are going to go through in the coming decades? Let me remind you that in the space of about 400 or 500 years, four or five empires came to their zenith and then faded away. We've had the British Empire. We've had our day. We're past. For the past 50 years, it's probably been the United States. Do you realize that that's all about to change? Do you realize that the world order is changing? Do you realize that in 20 years, if there's a congregation here in Boulder, Christchurch, it will be a totally different political landscape in this world? There's not only the rise of nationalism across the world and Islamization, and all the problems that that's bringing. There's global warming. There's a migration of populations trying to escape poverty and the effects of globalization and of warming. There's wars over water supplies. The United Nations say that the wars of the coming decades will be about the supply and control of fresh water supplies. Do you realize that there'll be continual wars over energy resources? Do you understand that Europe can be plunged into darkness and its factories closed just by the decision of one man? And he's in the Kremlin. And he has no interest in the West. His desire is to establish Russia as a great world power again. And he doesn't have to take weapons. He has it because Europe depends upon Russia for its energy supplies. And if you think that Putin is a nice fellow who will just agree to deals, you've got no idea. Do you understand that he sued British Petroleum and he's cancelled contracts where they sink billions of dollars into recovery of oil? That's going on right now. Do you realize that China has the greatest amount of cash that a nation has ever had in human history? $1 trillion of spare cash. If China was to lay its $1 trillion reserves end to end using dollar bills, the trail of paper would stretch 96,906,565 miles, or 3,876 times around the wider circumference of the earth. China has $1 trillion. Wow. But can I tell you something which is even more alarming? That America owes not $1 trillion. America has debts of $9 trillion. Do you understand this? That the Chinese government could cause the American economy to crash? And if they decided to do that, what would happen? Would make the 1930s crash a minor blip in economic history. And the only reason that the Chinese don't do that is because they've got so many dollars owed to them by America, it's not in their interest to do it as yet. Now, if you take those facts into consideration, can you understand that in the next couple of decades, it is going to be a totally different world? The changes that Jonah could see and which he was terrified of and he didn't want to deal with, they're going to be far bigger changes that we've got to come to terms with. Can I assure you that those statistics are not made up? You can go and see them for yourself. They are real. You can't escape from them. We've run out of oil in the North Sea. Our energy supplies are all coming from the continent. You know that last year, energy supplies went up 23%, the cost, and another 23%. And we're all at the mercy of people who are not particularly benignly sympathetic to us. So how do Christians respond to that? Shall I tell you how we respond? We respond in hope and in joy and in gladness that God is King of kings and Lord of lords, and none of this takes him by surprise. None at all. That China and India will be the dominant economic powers within the world within a matter of 20 or 30 years. Are we to be afraid of that? That Britain's significance will just shrink and shrink and shrink. Are we to be afraid of that? No, because God has been at work. And now in China, despite what Mao Zedong tried to do, there is over 100 million believers in China. And they're anxious to evangelize the world. Maybe God's saying the West has had its day. The West could have served me, but didn't. The West, in fact, has destroyed the very hope of the gospel. I'm now giving it to other nations. I'm giving it to other Christian communities. And that's where the hope of the gospel is. That what we failed to do, others might well be raised up to do. Brazil is emerging as a powerful nation. It's now the 10th most strongest economy in the world. Brazil is massively now evangelical Christians. They're sending missionaries out. Korea is the same, South Korea. God's been moving the balance of power. So the distress of Jonah, we can perhaps understandably realize why. The desire of Jonah. Next. Jonah says, when my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Jonah in his lostness and hopelessness, there in the sea, encased in the frame of a fish, remembers God. And this is when his hope begins. He is as far from God in terms of where he should be, because God is in Jerusalem. That's where you call upon God. You go to Jerusalem and call upon God. And here is now Jonah in the sea, and he is in human terms completely cut off from God, and yet he cries to God. He remembers God. I wish what I'm about to say was being said a little bit earlier in the service. Because I'd like to say to all those who've taken the children out, and all those of you who are working with children and young people, that your work is so valuable, so important, and you may not see the fruit of it even in the immediate coming years, but you're putting understanding, you're putting seed into the hearts and minds of children and young people. And maybe sometime in the future, in their darkness and in their despair, they will remember God. And they will cry to him. And even though you may never know what God did, he comes near to that individual that maybe you taught, maybe that you supported and encouraged. The desire of Jonah. He cries to God. The very desire to pray is there in his heart. It's a desire that God has put there. Do you ever doubt that God hears you? Do you realize that the very desire that God should intervene in your life, the very desire to cry to God, has been put there by God. And he never does that with the purpose of crushing your weak faith. He does that to support you, to strengthen you. And even though it might seem that you're so weak, he says, I'm not asking you to trust in your strength, I'm asking you to trust in my strength, which is made powerful in your weakness. The discovery of Jonah. Jonah says in chapter 2, verse 8, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. The English Standard Version has, those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. Look at the young population today. Look what they're doing on a Friday and Saturday evening. Watch Panorama tonight, if you can cope with it, to see how alcohol is taking hold of 9- and 10-year-old children, how it's destroying their lives, it's destroying their health, it's destroying their families, destroying communities. And why are they doing this? Because they have no knowledge or desire for God. And they think this is great, and they think this is how you are. But even look higher, look at the young executive, anxious to make a name and selling himself to the company as long as he can be on the board of directors and as long as he can have this fabulous paycheck and this fabulous house. And what's he doing? Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. There comes a point when it's realized all this has been relatively worthless because I've sacrificed the knowledge of God's steadfast love. Jonah had refused to give the people of Nineveh this opportunity of knowing God's steadfast love. If we're going to talk about being faithful to God, we've got to be serious about giving people the opportunity of knowing this same love. And Jonah's having to be taught that, and he's being brought to a place where he'll accept this commission. And finally, the deliverance of Jonah. Jonah says, "But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I vowed I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord." And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Jonah's deliverance begins in his heart. The fish vomiting is just the outworking of God's will. The deliverance has got to begin with Jonah wanting God. Wanting to fulfill God's will. Wanting to obey God. And there he comes to the point where he says, "Oh God, I'm the fool, you're wise. I ask for your forgiveness, I ask for your mercy, for your salvation." But that is a process. You don't ask God for miracles, you ask God to work in you, to change you. And even if it's just to enable you to cope with your circumstances, that's where you begin. If God chooses then to do a miracle, of whatever magnitude, that's his prerogative. But Jonah has turned to God and he's asked God for his help and for his intervention. When I was preparing for this, I went into the online encyclopedia, Wikipedia, and I looked at what they had to say about Jonah. And I want to finish with something which I found was quite helpful, in fact, very helpful. Because a person who was not particularly sympathetic to the book of Jonah being a historical document, but he said this: "This book tells a story of an apparently inept prophet who becomes one of the most effective prophets in the entire Bible. Who becomes one of the most effective prophets in the entire Bible. The man who'd run away from God, the man who'd argued with God, became the man who accepted, even though he was still reluctant, but he went to Nineveh and he preached to Nineveh, and Nineveh repented, the whole nation was changed." And in fact, when that person wrote that at Wikipedia, I doubt if he realized that the Assyrians still experience the blessing of that act of national repentance. Jonah is one of the most powerful prophets in the whole Old Testament. That's incredible, isn't it? So let's take heart. We may feel as though God has given up on us or whatever. He hasn't. Just like he'd not given up on Jonah.